Welcome to Baghdad Briefing, the Washington Post Iraq podcast. Today is Friday, August 22nd, and I'm Mike Schmuel, filling in for Middle East editor Cameron Barr. In this week's edition, we'll speak with Baghdad Bureau Chief Sudarshan Raghavan about his reporting from Diyala province, including his rattling experience on the, quote, road of hell with American and Iraqi soldiers. We'll also hear an episode of Iraq Diary from Baghdad Bureau reporter Khalid Al-Safar, who talks about the health problems facing a number of veteran Iraqi political figures. But first, we're joined by Post foreign correspondent Candice Rondeau, who is in Pakistan, where the Taliban claimed responsibility for a suicide bomb attack on Thursday that killed 70 people and injured over 100 more. This is the latest in a series of militant attacks against government targets in that country. Candice, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about the attacks on Thursday.
Well, this was on a very large military installation here just outside of the capital, about 25 miles outside of Islamabad. Three suicide bombers attacked a munitions factory here that supplies most of the Pakistani army. Two walked up to the gate, exploded their vests, and then another went to a separate gate and exploded his vest. This is a very heavily protected area inside a gated community that is primarily run by the military, although there are residences there for regular civilians. The attack happened at a time when there was a shift change at the factory, so there were hundreds of people at the gate, and hence the number of injuries, which actually ended up climbing quite a ways throughout the day.
And this is the latest in a series of attacks. Are they related at all to the resignation of President Pervez Musharraf on Monday? Do the militants see sort of a power vacuum in that country?
Well, I'm sure the militants have seen a power vacuum in the country for quite some time now. The crisis here, politically speaking, has been going on at least since early last year when Musharraf sacked a bunch of judges and ended up coming into conflict with a wide array of political opponents, which eventually led to his ouster. However, this attack really was a response to a bunch of military operations that have been ongoing for the past month or so in the tribal areas of Pakistan, which are extremely volatile. Both volatile and remote, and therefore difficult for the Pakistani army to control. In fact, the Taliban last struck a Air Force bus as it was headed toward Peshawar, which is one of the major cities in the northwest part of the country. This would be the second major attack on a military target in 2 weeks.
Yeah, and you mentioned this region, which is in northwest Pakistan and eastern Afghanistan, and it has seen quite a bit of violence this week. On Monday, you also reported that 10 French soldiers were killed when a NATO base was attacked by a group of Taliban fighters. The incident even prompted French President Nicolas Sarkozy to head to Afghanistan and pledge his support for the coalition efforts there. What made that attack different from previous ones in the area?
Well, the Taliban in Afghanistan has really ratcheted up its operations in and around, particularly the east, south. Now even we're seeing activity in the northeast. The significance of this attack is that it was just a little bit outside of Kabul, which is the capital. And lately, you know, there's been a lot of concern on the part of NATO officials as well as civilians who are working there with non-governmental organizations to help with redevelopment that the city of Kabul might come under attack soon. The other part, of course, that's unique about this is that, you know, the French only just now decided this year to augment their forces, I think probably against the better judgment of many people in France who I think don't necessarily support the war. Nonetheless, President Sarkozy did say he was here to reinforce the troops. The problem, of course, is that when you lose 10 soldiers at once in a major attack like this, I think the largest number since 1983, for French forces, really can put a dent in the kind of political support you have at home for this kind of engagement in a military operation.
And Sarkozy wants to send more troops to that region, like you just said. And even the Pentagon over here is thinking about sending about 12,000 additional troops to Afghanistan as the Taliban sort of recalibrates its attacks in that area. I guess two questions. What's the delay on sending the troops? And secondly, would an influx of soldiers, American soldiers, really quell the violence?
I'm not sure I can speak necessarily to the reasons for the delay, as many U.S. officials have said, that the number of troops that we now have in Iraq has something to do with the fact that we don't have the resources presently to send, you know, two or three brigades over here to help with the effort in Afghanistan. Would this mean that, you know, an additional number of troops coming in, would this make a change in sort of the balance of the war? It's possible, but as you can see, even in the South, where the Marines have recently surged, The number of attacks there has really gone up just in the past 3 months. And in fact, in the last 3 months, more foreign soldiers have been killed in Afghanistan than in Iraq. So yes, on some level, I'm certain that having more troops in the field might help maybe in the short term. But the long term, I think if you talk to a lot of people in Afghanistan who've been working on reconstruction and development, in the long term, it's really going to be reconstruction element, how fast they can get schools running, how fast they get electricity to people, and that's probably going to make the difference in terms of hearts and minds.
Candace, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Thanks, Mike.
We're now joined by Baghdad Bureau Chief Sudarshan Raghavan, who is back in Baghdad after reporting from Diyala province, a region that is proving to be a real test for the skill and resiliency of the Iraqi army. Sudarshan, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
First off, could you describe this area for our listeners?
Sure. Diyala province is located about 40 miles north of Baghdad. It is a largely rural province filled with date palm groves and large farms. In fact, it is famous for its dates, the region that is. And it's because of the nature of it, because of the vast farmlands and the date palms and all of that, it makes it a very effective hiding place for insurgent groups.
And what kind of operations do the American and Iraqi forces undertake in the province, and is it seen as a critical element to the success of Iraq?
Absolutely. Diyala province is basically one of the last strongholds of the insurgent group Al-Qaeda in Iraq, according to the U.S. and Iraqi military commanders. So they're devoting a lot of resources, a lot of manpower in trying to tame this province. The fighting itself is sort of non-traditional. You don't see any too much ground combat, but what you do see is many of the insurgents have fled these villages, which they controlled, and leaving behind large roads and farmland sort of peppered with roadside bombs. So the challenge is for the Iraqi and American military that backs them is basically it's just trying to get to these villages to clear them out. But in order to do so, they've got to basically try to unearth dozens and dozens of mines and all sorts of other bombs and traps that the insurgents have laid for them.
And you also wrote a compelling piece in the Field Notes section of the Post describing sort of the mine sweeps, and you and photographer Andrea Bruce had a pretty close call while you were with the troops. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. It was definitely one of the closer calls we've had. We were on this road. It was dubbed by villagers as the Road of Hell. And by the time we had gotten there, there had already been about 11 roadside bombs detected on this road. And we thought we were in an area that was already been cleared. In fact, everyone on that road thought it had been cleared when suddenly an armored American bulldozer basically ran over an anti-tank mine and it erupted. I was on one side. Andrea was on the other side, and I was basically about 30 feet away, and I could just, I was basically watching as Iraqi soldiers were kind of emerging through the smoke, clutching their heads, their faces bathed in blood, and I immediately ran in that direction because I was concerned that Andrea might have been injured. Fortunately, she was safe, I was safe, but it was nevertheless a horrific scare for the both of us.
Wow. Sudarshan, stay safe, and thanks for your reporting on this.
Thank you for having me.
We'll now hear an episode of Iraq Diary from Baghdad Bureau reporter Khalid Al-Safar, who describes the health problems facing some Iraqi politicians.
Top Iraqi leaders are ailing. The entire top echelon of Iraqi political class is having health problems. They are ailing, not only from the continuing political crisis, the still unsolved problems of violence, electric power shortage, the rising inflation, unemployment, the deterioration of services, and a myriad of problems which seem probably unsolvable. Many of them probably feeling powerless, frustrated, and unable to push things in the right direction may find themselves falling sick. Hypertension and heart problems are the major ailments from which they suffer. Many say the political crisis they face every day and the isolation in which they live inside the green zone, which separates them from their folks, friends, and constituents, as well as the atmosphere of conspiracies and skepticism surrounding them, helped in worsening their conditions, sending them flying to hospitals inside and outside Iraq. The latest to suffer illness was Parliament Speaker Dr. Mahmoud al-Mashhadani, 60 years old. He collapsed last week while waiting for a plane to take him to Amman, Jordan. At the airport, aides said he collapsed, suffering from hypertension and exhaustion. He was rushed in a plane to Amman, a mere 1.5 hours away, where he was immediately hospitalized. The director of his media office, Jabbar al-Mashhadani, no doubt a relative of his, said in Amman afterwards that Mashhadani's condition was stable after he underwent a heart operation. Mashhadani was taken to the royal wing of the Hussein Medical City of Amman. He was visited by King Abdullah of Jordan and is still there recuperating, but it is not sure if he will make it to the opening of the second legislative term during the first week of September, especially with all the squabbles going on about the provincial council's election law, which he played an instrumental role in passing. The Kurds are still sore with him, so he may prolong his stay in Jordan, at least to avoid the high temperatures of Baghdad's summer. Late in 2007, Mashhadani had a similar stroke and was taken to the Ibn Sina Hospital inside the heavily fortified Green Zone. President Jalal Talabani, who is 75 years old, has suffered from multiple health problems during the past 2 years. Recently, he underwent a heart operation at the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota, after sources close to him said he was suffering from a knee injury and would have to have an operation. As it turned out, the operation was in the heart, which Mayo Clinic said was successful. Talabani will remain hospitalized for a while, after which he will go to Washington for a speedy recovery. No doubt his being around the White House will help him tremendously, at least morally, because of his closeness to the Bush administration and the fact that his son, Qabad, is resident in Washington, D.C. Our other leader, Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, is 62 years old. Earlier this year, he chose the British capital, London, to conduct a series of medical checkups after he collapsed twice because of high blood pressure, which he suffered during the Basra battle last March, when he personally led the Iraqi military forces in a crackdown on outlaw groups and members of the Mahdi army who had refused to lay down their weapons. It is said at one point in the fighting, he and his entourage of associates and aides were surrounded by the insurgents. American helicopters ferried the group out of danger. About 2 months later, he returned to London for more checkups. Since then, he seemed to be in better health and may have lost some weight, but it is not certain if he will maintain that for a while. Another leader, Shiite Vice President Adel Abdel Mahdi, is also 62 years old. He had some medical checkups in Amman, Jordan, earlier this year. Reports said at the time he is following a strict diet, although in recent photos he did not appear to have lost any weight. He spent many years in France as an exile, so it can be a sure bet that if a chance for a trip to France comes along, he will do some more medical checkups there. We'll just have to wait and see. The leader of the powerful Supreme Iraqi Islamic Council, SIIC, Abdulaziz Hakim, chose the U.S. first and then Iran to fight his lung cancer, which he developed last year. He received treatment in Houston, Texas first, and then chose to continue treatment in Tehran, no doubt because of the familiar environment, because he had spent his exile years in Tehran. Kurdish leader Masoud Barzani is also 61 years old. He went earlier this year, to Italy for medical treatment. The nature of his illness was never disclosed, although he seems fit. Problems his son, Masrur, is facing in Austria may cause him some real heart problems. A Kurdish journalist has filed a legal suit accusing Masrur of physically assaulting him. Masroor is the chief of the Kurdish Region Intelligence Service. The case has drawn attention to the Barzani's record of human rights abuses. Another leader is Sunni Vice President Tariq al-Hashir. He chose to go to Turkey to have his sinus operation there, where he was warmly welcomed by the Turkish officials. No doubt, their sense of camaraderie in the face of the Shiites played a large role in establishing the sense of closeness and harmony between Tariq al-Hashimi and his Turkish friends. Another Sunni leader is outspoken Sunni leader Khalaf al-Ulayan, head of the National Dialogue Council, one of the three main factions making the Sunni Iraqi National Accordance Front. He was absent from the political scene for at least 2 months after undergoing operations on his knee in Jordan. Another leader, former Prime Minister Ayad Alawi, is 63 years old. He had an operation in London sometime last year after he had a heart stroke. Observers have noted that the choice of the country where the medical treatment or checkups are done depends to a large degree on political preferences rather than medical choice, and reveals how close this leader is to life and political affiliation to that country. The recurring health problems afflicting Iraqi leaders also shed light on the poor health facilities and mediocre medical talent who remained in the country after many of the best medical doctors and specialists were either killed or forced to flee out of fear for their lives. This should be a cause for more efforts to shape up the state of healthcare in the country, at least to a level where political leaders can have treatment inside Iraq and not have to scurry to foreign hospitals.
And that does it for another edition of Baghdad Briefing. If you have any questions or comments, you can send us a note at baghdadbriefing, one word, @washpost.com. Please join us again next week. Thank you.